Welcome, everyone. Episode 359 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have a lot to get through today. We're going to start off with an Eastern Conference Finals preview. We will then talk about what's next for the Toronto Raptors. We'll touch on Michael Porter Jr. wanting the ball more, and then we've got to hit the Daniel House situation as well. Before we get into all of that, a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is a guy who should also stay off Twitter for the next 2 weeks, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
It's going well, outside of me being bombarded by Bulls fans who are upset with me for daring airing out the idea of trading Lauri Markkanen. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my mentions have also been a crime scene ever since I preemptively was just like, oh God, the Sixers are going to think Russell Westbrook is the answer this offseason. And people have just started running. It's like half of... It seems like most people are, like, outside fans just laughing and be like, oh, that's a terrible idea. I definitely want to see it. But then there are also some Sixers fans who are like, oh, that's a terrible idea. I definitely want to see it.
Well, so. It is. It is a terrible idea.
Oh, the
worst. And that's why it's great. It's great.
It's going to happen. I'm just trying to get everyone ready for it.
Well, you know what? Since we're in the trade frenzy, do you want Lauri Markkanen? I mean...
I would.
We can figure something out.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you posted that piece this morning, and I immediately started thinking, like, man, if Markkanen's really up for sale, a lot of teams should be after him.
Like, that's where you and I differ. I was actually struggling coming up with trade ideas, not just because he's an upcoming free agent. Let's just take 2 minutes to get this out of the way. Mm-hmm. But also because he's a power forward, and more so with like a traditional power forward. You know, even though he can stretch the floor, he's not a playmaker. He's not a defender. He's not a high caliber rebounder. Like, he'll always be primarily a scoring four. And I'm looking around the league, and I'm just not seeing that guy on successful teams. You know, before we start recording, you know, you and I talked a little bit about this. You brought up Danilo Gallinari, but I would argue he's so much better in terms of handling the basketball and passing the basketball that gives him an edge. And that's why I think the Bulls need to move off of Markkanen, because who out there wins with that archetype of player?
Yeah, I mean, OKC would be one team that I could see being interested in him, especially if the Bulls are willing to sell, you know, not at full value, or they're just like looking to get off of him because they don't want to pay his next contract.
Right.
Just because he's young, I could see him fitting with SGA pretty well. Presumably, as we touched on last episode, presumably need a Gallo replacement this offseason. But yeah, I mean, you run into this problem a lot with trade ideas in general, where you're like, huh, actually, not very many teams need a player at this position. It's like every single team, if you would talk about a, like 3-and-D wing or a two-way wing, every single team would be lined up and interested. But then when you're trying to trade a power forward or a center, it's like, well, actually, most teams are pretty well set. Even the bad teams. Like, Sacramento does not need another big. Like, they should be in talent acquisition mode, but that is one area that they don't need to acquire more talent.
One thing I will say, which I thought was interesting, there was a Spurs fan who picked up that piece I wrote, was like, yes, I want Lauri Markkanen. Yeah, 11 for Markkanen, that's fine. And I was like, yeah, the Bulls should definitely take that. They should take that immediately, and then they should smirk like the Grinch, because that's a good deal. That could get them a guy like Devin Vassell. And if you pick Denny at 4, who would then go in and be, you know, your playmaking power forward in the sort of Gallo sense, but more advanced ball handling wise, you would suddenly have, you know, at least LaVine, Vassell, and Denny, who can sort of handle the basketball all a little bit, and then you would have Wendell Carter Jr., who is a facilitator as well. Then you would suddenly have a very unselfish offense. I kind of dig that more so than trying to pigeonhole Markkanen into this, you know, star role at the 4.
Yeah, and I could actually like that for the Spurs a lot too, regardless of whether they keep LaMarcus Aldridge or trade him this offseason. If they keep him, you know, who better to learn from at that position than a guy like Aldridge, who's really kind of transformed his game over time. And if they trade him, I mean, you've still got the young guards in Murray, White, Lonnie Walker. Now you add a piece like Markkanen to plug next to Jakob Poeltl, and like the Spurs have a quietly very interesting young core as well.
That could be fun. I would objectively look at that. I would enjoy the Spurs in that sense. And I know full well that they won't necessarily go that far, because I just don't think a team with Markkanen playing a vital role will go very far. But they would be fun to watch. And I actually like Markkanen. Just let me get that out of the way first and foremost. I actually like the dude.
Yeah. Yeah, you're just, I mean, especially given Wendell Carter's presence, you're just skeptical of whether the two will fit long-term together.
That too. I mean, who in 2020 in the NBA decides, hey, let's build around a power forward and center combination?
Oh, I can tell you. I can tell you, yeah, one team.
I know, but good teams.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Look how that went.
Right. I want to go all in on the positionless in this year. That's what I want. I just want to see teams in general just lean into this no positions thing. But it's also so difficult for us podcasters and writers, because then if someone asks us, so who would you take for this and that? Because they're kind of short on this end. Like, yeah, they could really use a small forward. Oh, no, we can't say small forward because positions doesn't exist anymore. Like,
right.
We still need some way to categorize players, I think.
Well, I mean, I really think Brad Stevens, you know, ball handler, wing, big is the more correct. Like I was telling you right before we started, you know, I was watching Game 7 with my wife, Alex, last night. And when she was trying to, like, she was asking me, like, what position does this guy play? What position does this guy play? I'm like, it doesn't really matter. It's like, I cannot tell you if Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown at any given time is a 3 or a 4, because they are completely interchangeable on both ends of the court. So they're just both wings. Like, I don't care what the positional archetype is. Now, you know, do teams like Toronto, I would say, for most of the season, did have a too big look. You know, whether it's Siakam or Gasol, Siakam or Ibaka, Ibaka or Gasol, they tended to succeed with two bigs on the floor at one time. But then we saw in this Boston series in particular, you know, when the rubber met the road and they like absolutely needed to stay on the floor to survive, they also downsized. So, I mean, I think that's kind of the big question, the team building question moving forward is like, okay, the two big thing can work. We saw it with the Lakers too in the regular season, Anthony Davis is the 4, you know, Dwight Howard, JaVale McGee were the 5s. Now that they're playing the Rockets, they've realized, okay, we can play their game and just beat them at it. We have Anthony Davis at the 5, where, you know, we could still win despite not taking advantage of our size. So we will downsize and we'll put, you know, Markieff Morris in the starting lineup, and we'll still be able to win that way.
Right. And I'll even say, and we can actually go straight into Toronto more or less, because, you know, this is a good point to raise. In terms of their bigs, they're all defensively inclined. Like Gasol, good defender. Ibaka, good defender. Siakam, good defender. OG Anunoby, who can also swing up to the 4, very good defender. So I think even for them, that's an asset. It comes down to what you can offer. Now, if you find me a traditional power forward who can defend his ass off and playmake, sort of like Draymond Green, I'm all good with that, because he fits. He fits into everything. Like, the problems I have with Draymond specifically is more so him being a reluctant shooter and him, you know, chirping all the time. It's not so much about his game. If you can find me a power forward who gives me those, you know, those qualities, fair. I'll take that every single day. I just don't like the idea of going out and prioritizing an offensive-minded 4 who can't really do a whole lot else.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for Markkanen to have real, you know, franchise cornerstone potential moving forward, I think he can play the 4 and he can play next to another big, but he also needs to prove that he could be a small ball 5 at times.
Yeah, and so far he just has not proven that. And I think ultimately, that's why I'm proposing what I'm proposing for the Bulls, because I think there, it would be interesting to see, you know, more of a new age lineup. Maybe it's also, you know, a well-hidden thing inside of me, having seen the Bulls being constantly 20 years behind the curve, that I suddenly want to see them being just slightly more progressive. That could be a factor as well, I'll admit.
Right. Well, we'll get back to Toronto in a few minutes, but I think we should start with the Eastern Conference Finals. The matchup that 2020 deserves, the hellscape that is Boston versus Miami.
Oh, Twitter's going to be so much fun.
So I think, honestly, my only two silver linings from this series, one, it's going to force Sixers management to just relish in their mistakes over and over and over again for 2 weeks, which is great. Like, I'm just here for the pain at this point. And two, the reaction from the fan base that loses every game will be phenomenal. Yeah. Like, whichever team wins is going to be annoying as hell. I'm going to mute every single Celtics, Heat, whatever term that night. But then the other team, I'm just going to, like, go on their Reddit and just enjoy for hours, because they're going to be melting down every time. It'll be great. But no, I mean, like, on court, terrible fan base aside, this is going to be a really fun matchup. I mean, it's two teams that, as you were just talking about, they've embraced the modern era. You know, they can both play a number of different styles. I mean, I think Miami, what they did to Milwaukee was so far the biggest story of the playoffs. Like,
yeah,
dispatching the title favorite that easily. We talked about it. Giannis was hurt for part of it. It doesn't matter. Like, Giannis was healthy in games 1 and 2. And Miami still took him to the woodshed. So I think these two teams match up pretty well with one another, actually. But which matchups are you focused on in particular going into this series?
Probably Jaylen Brown, Jimmy Butler, or Jimmy Butler on Jason Tatum. Whoever, you know, however they end up matching up. I have a feeling Jimmy's going to basically be guarding both of them on numerous occasions, and they too are going to take turns on him. So that's going to be interesting to me. But more specifically, and this is not specifically a matchup, but I'm just going to be intrigued to see how the Heat guard Tatum. Because one thing is guarding Giannis when he made it a little bit easy on Miami by just keep dribbling into walls of defenders. Like, I'm replaying that series a lot in my head, and I just cannot comprehend Giannis did not play smarter. Like, I objectively think he played dumb basketball for a significant period of time in that series. And it blows my mind, because I usually look at him as a very intelligent player, but I don't know if he just lost his head. But okay, Tatum is so different, because he can actually handle a ball so much better in terms of creating shots for himself, especially jump shots. This is something you and I have talked about so much, and especially when it relates to the Sixers of last year with Jimmy Butler, given that, you know, you had that one guy who can create himself jump shots and no one else. So having that guy who, one thing is you can create yourself a dribble drive towards the basket. Okay. But the fact that you can dribble your way into situations where you can cross over, step back, do a wide variety of moves that ends up with you separating yourself from the defender and being able to take a three or a mid-range or whatever, that changes games. That changes games. And this is a 22-year-old Jason Tatum who in the playoffs right now is averaging over 25 points, 10 rebounds and 4 assists per game. I mean, we always talk about players who are great in the regular season, and we ask the question, can this translate to the playoffs? We are seeing the birth of a superstar here, because this is a guy who does produce in the playoffs. This is a guy who doesn't seem to be fazed whatsoever about defenses who throw every kind of wicked scheme at him. He just finds a way to get his shot off, and reliably so. Mm-hmm. So for me, I'm just going to be keyed in on how Miami defends him. I have no idea. They're probably going to ask Jimmy to just hound him, but is that going to be enough?
Well, I mean, that's the good thing for Miami, is they have a number of wing defenders they can throw at both Tatum and Brown. They have Jimmy, they have Jay Crowder, they have Andre Iguodala. It wouldn't shock me to see Bam Adebayo on Jaylen Brown in particular at times.
Yeah. Okay. I thought you were going to say Tatum, because that's one thing I've talked about.
Honestly, I mean, you know, again, it goes back to, like, their positions don't really matter. Like, I think they'll throw all of those guys at both Tatum and Brown at different times. I mean, I think the key to beating Boston in the series is just, you know, keeping them off guard, like being unpredictable. And Spoelstra is a great coach. He will do that. I have zero concern. This is not going to be Mike Budenholzer, you know, part two. Like, Brad Stevens and Spo are both great coaches. We just saw it in the Boston-Toronto series as well. That was just, like, a extremely well-coached, well-played, fantastic series, especially, you know, those last couple of games where it was like a chess match at a slugfest, which you don't often see together. And I think this upcoming series will be that as well.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'll challenge you a little bit, though. Because I know that we keep referring to Andre Iguodala and Jay Crowder as great defenders. You know, I think it's pretty apparent that Iggy has lost a step, though.
Yeah.
Like, just athletically, which I understandable. He's, what, 36? 35, 36? Like, it makes sense that he's lost a step. Crowder is the intriguing thing here, because he's not really that quick. He's more built. Like, he's more physical defense. And I wonder if that's going to matter at all if the guys like Jalen and Tatum, Jason, those two names are just so close.
Always.
Yeah, always. Given the fact that both of them, like I said before, can separate themselves from the defender, I wonder if when Crowder guards them, does that make any difference for him? You know, for them, if they can just separate themselves from him, okay, because he's not necessarily great at challenging shots. He's just really good at bodying himself up on people. And as we saw this year, I mean, we could make the argument that Jaylen Brown should have been in the All-Star game. He took a quantum leap in terms of being able to handle the basketball. And like, he was a three-dribble player last year. Now he can actually go a whole possession by just keeping his dribble alive. That's a significant improvement. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Miami's defenders, they have to basically run themselves tired every game chasing around those two. And Kemba. My God, I completely forgot Kemba in this as well. So it's going to be a huge strain on Miami. Whereas if Toronto had won, I would have said Miami pretty comfortably.
Yeah.
And now I'm actually swinging Boston's side. That was the big thing for me with that series, you know, that went seven. Whoever won would probably be... that would change the fate of Miami.
Yeah. Yeah, it wouldn't shock me if Miami wins game one just because Boston is going to be physically exhausted. They'd be playing a double overtime in game six and now this series, game seven, 2 days later. The good thing is the Eastern Conference Finals don't start until Tuesday, so Boston does get 3 days of rest. But, you know, Miami's been chilling for, by that point, they'll have been chilling for a full week, so they'll, you know, they'll be rested and raring to go. I'm glad
Boston is young, though. Yeah. They have young legs.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up Kemba, because I actually think that's one where there's just a clear advantage on Boston's side. I mean, against Toronto, you know, Kyle Lowry is just an absolute pesky son of a bitch. And, you know, you just hate going against him. And Fred VanVleet as well can, you know, really get in your face at times and gum things up for you. You know, Miami has been starting Goran Dragic in the playoffs, and he's been fantastic offensively, but I don't think he has any chance keeping up defensively against Kemba. So, I think the key, one of the keys for Boston in this series, because Miami could potentially, you know, I don't want to say completely, like, shut down Tatum or Brown, but they could at least harass them into having some inefficient games or some game where like Tatum only has 12 points on 5 of 14 shooting or something like that. So Kemba needs to be, you know, a guaranteed 20 point per game scorer in this series. Like they need to attack that mismatch until Miami figures out a counter, and whether that is putting one of these wing guys on Kemba, and, you know, maybe Jimmy guards Kemba and then you put Iggy and Crowder on Tatum and Brown. Like, you just got to figure out some way to stop all three of those guys. And I think it's going to be tricky for Miami to find the offense-defense balance to do so.
I like that idea. I like the Jimmy on Kemba idea. That's going back. That's the old Scottie Pippen on Mark Jackson thing in 98. I always love to see that because I do think that great defensive wings are really well suited at shutting down. Not shutting down. We can't say shutting down in 2020 because it's not a thing anymore, but right. Definitely affect point guards.
Yeah.
Because if you can stop an effective point guard getting into the offense and just basically shaving off a significant portion of the shot clock, you know, that team would have to play catch up. You know, every set you run would have to be executed that much quicker, and that can lead to panic, and that can lead to a lot of rush shots. So I like that idea from Miami.
Yeah, and then the other thing to keep in mind is Adebayo on paper has a pretty significant advantage over Daniel Tice, but Daniel Tice has been playing really well in these playoffs.
Oh, yeah.
So oh, yeah. If he can even come close to equalizing that is another thing that can swing this series in Boston's favor in particular. Like, as good as Kemba needs to be, Bam needs to be that good for Miami to have a chance in the series, I think.
Yeah, and he could be. I mean, we're not saying that Tice is going to shut down Bam or anything, but he's going to make it work for it. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. And I think maybe this is one of those series where Bam may have to look a little bit more at the free throw line jumper, honestly, because I do have a sense that Tice would back off a little bit and mm-hmm. they would allow him to take that shot. But as we've talked about before, Bam actually has a very good looking jump shot. So if he can start draining that at a high percentage to the extent that Boston would have to come up and actually attack him, that could change some things. But overall, I'm not digging Miami's chances overall in this series.
Yeah, I'm not either. I think you're right that Miami would have had a much better chance against Toronto than Boston. I just think Boston, you know, because they can throw either Tatum or Brown at Jimmy. And then, you know, we don't know the status of Gordon Hayward. Brad Stevens last night said he doesn't know either. He expects him back at some point in the series, but it's unclear when. But that's just another guy. I mean, I don't expect Hayward coming off of that injury to be 100% full strength like the Hayward that he was during the regular season when he was actually really good and looked like his old self. Right. But that'll just be another thing for Miami to have to counteract. And then, like, Marcus Smart has just been playing his balls off in these playoffs. He's been fantastic. And, you know, that's just another guy that they can throw at Jimmy or at Goran Dragic or at Duncan Robinson. Like, whoever Marcus Smart is guarding is in for a hell of a series.
Tyler Hero.
Yeah.
The guy. I want Marcus Smart to just basically do everything in his power to shut down Tyler Hero. Because Tyler is one of those guys who comes in and just he's a rhythm player and not necessarily a guy who builds his own rhythm. Like if Miami is hitting shots, like if Duncan Robinson has hit a couple J's, you know, that somehow feeds into Tyler Hero and he'll start knocking down. It becomes an avalanche. So if you take that element away, just that whole rhythm player thing, and you kind of force him into playing more of a set offense, then you can take him out of the game. And if there's a guy out there I trust to do that, it's Marcus Smart.
Yeah, that's a great call. That is absolutely. And, you know, you were saying you can't say, like, a race in 2020. That might be one of the rare cases where you could say, like, Marcus Smart could more or less completely erase Tyler Hero in this series. And, I mean, they're going to need him to have a big series, to have a chance. And, so that very, very good call there. So, I mean, it sounds like both of us are leaning pretty heavily toward Boston in the series. But what do you think would need to happen for Miami to win?
So one of the downsides to Boston right now is still their lack of depth. They just don't have much, especially after Gordon Hayward went down or left the bubble. You know, look at their players right now coming off the bench. I think I actually raised this point in the article I wrote about marketing because I had a Boston trade proposal in there that only 16% of Boston's offense in the game series against Toronto came off the bench. You know, of the points, 16.3% of their points came from their bench. That's a lot of reliance on your starting lineup. That means you're not getting offensive production from your bench whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Miami needs to basically see, okay, if we can tire out just some of these top-tier starters, maybe if we can make Jason Tatum take 25 shots to score 30 points, we'll do that because we'll survive when the bench comes in because they just have nothing to offer offensively. I mean, Brad Wanamaker led the bench scoring against Toronto with 5.7 points a game. That's not a lot of offense.
Yeah.
So I think for Miami, it boils down to how much can we limit the starting lineup and how many percentage points or efficiency points can we kind of shut them down with? How much can we shave off and then force the bench to actually beat us?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great call. And again, I think, you know, the Bam matchup, he needs to resoundingly win that, and they need to figure out some way to slow down Kemba. You know, I could see this being like a Boston in five type thing otherwise.
It could. It could also go seven, which would be fantastic. And by the way, you and I did not get disappointed. Remember when we said the only thing that would disappoint us in the Celtics-Raptors series was if it went less than six?
Yeah.
We got the full seven.
Yeah.
So right here on this podcast, let's just utter that prediction again with this series, because this is one that I want to go seven.
I agree. Mostly, again, to see the meltdown from the fan base that loses in Game 7.
Well, I mean, Sixers fans would go crazy having seven games of watching Jimmy Butler and Jason Tatum going at it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. All right, let's pivot now to the Raptors because they are now facing... I mean, first of all, before we get into the offseason, kudos to the Raptors, man. They were... Yeah. 0.5 seconds from being down 3-0 to force a game seven where, I mean, they were within spitting distance at the end. If Marcus Smart doesn't block Norman Powell's shot, it's a tie game with less than a minute left. So, you know, for all of the slander that the Raptors caught over the years, especially during the LeBron James sweep them out of the playoff era, they proved like that winning the championship that year has just completely changed that franchise. And like, they just have the confidence in themselves moving forward to know that, like, no deficit is too big. It was remarkable. Just a remarkable job. This was, you know, I know a lot of Raptors fans are saying, like, this is their favorite season or this was their favorite team to watch. And I can understand that.
Yeah, I would still go with last year if I was a Raptors fan, but that's also because I absolutely love Kawhi Leonard. But, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it.
Yeah. But now we have to talk about them moving forward because they have a lot of big decisions to make, starting with Fred VanVleet. He is a free agent this offseason. He will be one of the few guys, I think, who will have a lot of interest around the league. What do you think is the right price for Fred VanVleet moving forward?
So this has been a topic that we've actually talked about on TV too, because the two hosts... you know, that comment on NBA games, you know, they usually get a lot of questions in, and that is one of the dominating questions they get each and every night. And I'm on the sidelines. I'm also like looking over, you know, players with, you know, similar skill set and contract value and whatnot. And it's still so difficult to gauge because of one thing, you know, the finances in play right now, you know, the fact that we simply don't know when the 2020-2021 season will start. But I think somewhere in the $20 million area we probably need to look there. We're not going down to like the 15, 16 million, I think. That would surprise me.
Yeah.
I think we need to look above 20. And then I think the Raptors should also be a little bit careful. I don't think there's any reason to go like too far. Like, if it's like $27 million a year, I think you need to look in the mirror and go, is that really what we're doing here?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe something along the lines of $20-21 million a year.
So if the Knicks offer him a max contract, you say just walk away.
Oh, if it's a yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. He's not a max guy. And it's also for a different reason. we need smart NBA teams to just basically say, you know what, if you are going to overpay that drastically, fine. Mm-hmm. You go ahead and you get that contract. So Chris Middleton with a max and Tobias Harris with a max. You know, if some teams get outbid by that, you should be willing to just say, fine, and let that player walk.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, just not an asset.
It's like what was formerly known as like an auction fantasy draft, now being called salary cap fantasy draft, where, you know, the first couple guys off the board, for I'm thinking in NFL terms because these just happen, but we could talk about NBA too. Like, oh, you know, peak LeBron James, Giannis Antetokounmpo will go for like $75 of your $200 budget. And, you know, it's an overpay, but you're like, okay, I'm paying for that talent. But then there, and some people go with like the quote unquote stars and scrubs strategy. And then other people like me just let people spend all their money. And then you can start plucking value very quickly in this thing. Right. So it's like, I mean, that is definitely a strategy is okay. Knicks, you want to give Fred VanVleet a max? Cool. Like, it sucks to lose him. We love him. But that takes you out of the market for future guys. Like, if we think you are a threat for Giannis in 2021 and you're paying Fred VanVleet a max, now you are no longer a threat for Giannis. So it will benefit us down the line to take you out of the market. So I'm with you. I mean, I think like a 5-year, $125 million deal would not make me feel great, especially... I mean, the market dynamics here are really interesting because there are going to be teams that have cap space this summer, but it won't be that many. And then, you know, hopefully by the time the offseason starts, the NBA has a plan in place not only for next season, but for 2021-22 as well. Because I think it's hard to build a team not knowing, you know, there are reasons that projections get mapped out a couple years in advance. So you can say, okay, this is not only what I expect next year, but like then I can also budget in a 6% increase the year after that. So if I give someone 8% raises every year, that contract isn't going up substantially with the cap. With this, I mean, it sounds like the prevailing thought is the cap will stay flat next year. But Bobby Marks and I think Tim Bontemps of ESPN have now reported a couple different times that there's some expectation it's going to stay flat in 2021 as well. Yeah. So, you know, I part of me wonders whether a lot of guys aren't going to want to sign a 5-year deal and they're going to want to line their deal up for whenever the cap increase starts again. But then, I mean, they might also prefer long-term financial security now, knowing that, you know, cap space isn't going to be as prevalent in future years as expected. Like, it was supposed to be $125 million in 2021. If it stays at $109 million, that is $16 million per team that just, poof, gone. Right. So, I think that is one thing to keep in mind with this deal as well for anyone, not even Fred VanVleet, just anyone signing a contract this offseason. You almost want to sign it and structure it in a way where either it's decreasing in value or at least staying flat in value. Because if it increases with the 8% annual raises every year, it's going to take up a larger share of your salary cap every season from here on out until the cap starts increasing again.
Which is why the Pacers were pretty smart. If you look at their cap sheet, it's pretty clean.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they haven't gotten a whole lot of contract that just ascends in value. And they also keep them. They like round numbers, which I always think is so much easier to work with. And by the way, now that we're on the subject of guaranteeing or securing players themselves long-term contracts because, you know, we're going into a sort of unpredictable future, let's just say immediately to all the sponsors listening, you know, we too, Brian, have lowered our salary demands. We used to say, well, we just need $1 million. We understand it's tough times. We'll settle for $500,000. It's okay. Yep. We understand.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm interested to see what happens with VanVleet this summer. And I think that is the biggest storyline for the Raptors. But they also have Marc Gasol is expiring, Serge Ibaka is expiring, and then Kyle Lowry's heading into the last year of his deal. At $30.5 million.
I actually think these are the bigger stories for one reason, because you actually said this. You said this about 10 minutes ago. You said that the best thing that happened to this Raptors squad was winning the championship, because they're just not afraid anymore. They're coming in with full confidence. What the hell happens then if you let a significant portion of that championship team walk? Does that team then lose its luster? Does that lose them their edge? Do you almost have to retain them just to make sure that that competitive fire is still there, so that can just sort of spread into the young guys that you take on?
And I would even go you one further, because I think if they lose Ibaka or Gasol, I don't know mentally if it will be like, oh no, like that was the heart of our team and now they're gone. Kyle Lowry is the heart of that team.
Yeah.
If they decide to go in a different direction, like if they give Fred VanVleet all of the money and they have Pascal Siakam signed to a long-term deal and OG Anunoby's coming up for an extension this offseason or will be a free agent next year, and they say, we're pivoting, we're getting younger, we're taking a step back, do they look to trade Kyle Lowry, or do they say, like, oh crap, we realize, you know, the value that you bring on the court speaks for itself, but then also, like, you are the emotional heart of this team. We can't trade you.
I think you have to make that call and say, you know, we're going to keep you around at the very least, and we're going to have to make concerted effort in getting those guys back on preferably lesser deals, because, I mean, look, $23 million per year for Serge Ibaka and $25 for Gasol, that's just not relevant anymore. They both have to take significantly lesser deals. But no, I think you have to stick with Kyle. You have to stick with Kyle, even if you do keep Fred for an obscene amount of money. Because at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, who, like you said, who is the culture setter? That's Kyle Lowry.
Yeah, I mean,
it really is.
I was just watching that game last night and thinking, like, if they decide to move on, you know, Sixers Twitter's throwing out all sorts of names for, you know, Chris Paul, Buddy Hield, even Zach LaVine. And, like, if Kyle Lowry's available, he is the guy they should go after. Like, I don't think Toronto does it. They certainly don't do it for Tobias Harris or Al Horford. But, you know, if Kyle Lowry is on the market, I can understand why they wouldn't want to do so. And honestly, at this point, I mean, Kyle Lowry, you know, after they traded DeMar DeRozan, looked checked out. And, you know, now fast forward 2 years, and, like, I feel like he's going to retire. He could be a Raptor for life. Like, I don't think they're going to, I don't think going into the last year of his deal, they're thinking, oh crap, like, Kyle Lowry is going to leave us next year and leave us empty handed. Like, I would assume he would want to come back. You know, the comments that he said last night after the game is like, it sucks, we had more to give. So, I feel like he is very much team run it back here. But it's just, you know, something that's lingering in the back of my mind, because I feel like if they do decide to trade him, they could get somewhat significant value for him, despite his contract's huge, but, you know, it's expiring. Right. Who cares? But I think he's proven his value, especially in the playoffs these past 2 years. And I think that, you know, it just wouldn't surprise me, even though he is the heartbeat of that team, for Masai to realize, like, it might be time to cash out.
Yeah. No, but again, and that's what you have to weigh, I think. I mean, if you can't get a significant talent upgrade, or not talent upgrade, but a future talent upgrade, so if you get someone who's younger, like in the mid-20s or something, who's on the upward trajectory, yes, sure, you have to consider it, but you just have to balance it against, like you said, you know, that confidence that they got.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing that can happen to an NBA team is them losing their identity. I think the Spurs have done pretty well. You know, they kind of siphoned out at different times, and I still think the Spurs, you know, mentality as a brand is still there, even though Tim isn't there, or Manu isn't there, or Tony isn't there anymore. Like, because they didn't all leave at the same time, it feels like, okay, you know, you could sort of spread that to the other teammates. And for Kyle, I mean, you know, what do you do here? Because he's the one guy who keeps everything flowing, like you said, mentally.
Mm-hmm.
If that trade is there for a better player, or a guy who will be a better player in a couple of years, is that worth it if you lose the collective mentality of the team?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the toughest question of team building. I think it's, Boston probably had that same question when they considered trading Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett, and then they just, they saw the package that they were offered and couldn't turn it down. But
yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it's a perverse overpay, you do it because right. You have to.
Right. But I mean, I bring up Milwaukee. They're a popular talking point for Chris Paul. Would Kyle Lowry not be even an arguably better fit for them?
Oh, for sure.
I wonder if that's, the big move that no one is really talking about right now that should be on the radar, at least. Not that I think it's especially likely, but that feels like the potential. We are moving in a different era for the Raptors. Let's get something of significant value in return. I think right. They probably could this offseason. I think a lot of teams would look at Kyle Lowry and be like, oh yeah, that could be our missing piece.
It is going to be an interesting offseason, that's for damn sure.
Indeed. Let's pivot now more to the Denver Nuggets, who I thought we would also be having their offseason conversation today, and they surprised me by putting up a real fight. They got down very early in game 5 last night, and I think we're down 15 in the second quarter. Came back and won it. Michael Porter Jr. had some big clutch moments at the end, which was redemption for him, because after game 4, Mort, he had 15 points in the first half of game 4. He finished the game with 15 points. After the game, he was asked why he couldn't keep his scoring going, and he said, I just didn't touch the ball. They didn't do anything differently. Then he continued, that is up to the play calling, the coaches, and whose hands they want to put the ball in. We kept going to Jokic and Murray, and they are two amazing players, but I just think to beat them, we need to get more players involved. So after he said that, Damian Lillard in particular had some emphatic Twitter comments just basically crapping all over MPJ. John Hollinger of The Athletic tweeted the next morning that, the medical was the main reason that he fell, but he kind of alluded to some potential character concerns as well as being another potential reason that Michael Porter fell to 14 to the Nuggets.
Let's find the actual tweet, because the actual tweet that Hollinger put out was awesome. Let's be honest. That was very fun. Let's see. Let me just look it up. My apologies. But
well, in the meantime, what did you think of MPJ's comments?
So I understand where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. I'll say as much. But I think there's a time and a place. Mm-hmm. To air out those issues. And I think for a guy like Dame to comment what he did was basically saying, hey, guy, something has to be kept in-house. Yeah. That's just better. Yeah. That is preferable. Because if you just go to the media, you're going to lose the respect of your teammates. Mm-hmm. I have it here. John Hollinger. How do I put this gently? Medical was by far the main reason he fell in the draft. It might not have been the only reason.
Yeah. So, I mean...
And this is a four-man executive, by the way, just so we don't forget. This isn't just the athletic John Hollinger. This is a guy who was in Memphis, what, 7 years?
7 years, yeah.
Yeah.
So, it came off as reminiscent of young Kobe, almost. Just like, you think so highly of yourself that... it's get me the damn ball more. And I can understand his frustration. And I can understand why Dame is kind of saying, like, hey, man, get in line, keep that in house. Because I agree. Like, the airing it, throwing your coach under the bus after you just go down 3-1 in a playoff series is not a great look.
Right.
But he is talented enough for them to, for him to issue such a demand. Like, we've been saying this really all playoffs. Like, the ultimate ceiling of this Nuggets team is going to come down more than just Jokic and Murray. It's going to come down to Michael Porter Jr. And I don't think they're going to win this series. I think the Clippers will close them out at some point. So I don't think they're quite at the like legitimate championship contender yet. But they aren't far away, and they're going to need Michael Porter Jr. to get there.
Right. I agree. But at the same time, you know, we're so caught up in the amount of shots he got. We kind of forget that he really has not played great defense in this series.
Or the playoffs in general. I mean, Utah
right.
actively targeted him that whole first round.
That is fair. But, I mean, that kind of plays into it as well. I mean, does he think the teammates doesn't recognize that? One thing is the teammates should be able to separate, well, okay, you know, you're an offensive player. We need to get you the ball on that end of the floor. Fine. But there is this thing where if a guy continuously just does not put in the effort defensively, teammates will notice and they will get upset and they will, you know, maybe unintentionally take that out of you or trust you less to the point where when they have the ball in their hands, they're looking around and when they see you who have not participated defensively over the past five possessions, they think, I can't trust that guy. I need to move it in a different direction. Mm-hmm. That matters. It isn't just like one. You can't separate the two ends of the floor from a teammate personality perspective. You just can't. So I think, you know, this conversation is layered. It really is. And yes, I think it would be better for the Nuggets to get him the right shots at the right time. But, oh, man, you know, I have a hard time accepting him sitting there going, I need more shots, and then constantly blowing every single defensive rotation in history.
I agree with that, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, it's kind of like you have to look short-term versus long-term. Does he need more shots right now? Arguably, yes, but that's just because, I mean, I you know, we talked about this in the Milwaukee-Miami series. Like, the worst thing you could do in the playoffs is get predictable, and if your offense is strictly flowing through Jokic and Murray, then it's going to be easier to defend. Like, if they know Michael Porter Jr. is an actual threat, great. But if you're going to take terrible shots or play terrible defense, then, you know, I can understand why his teammates, as you said, don't necessarily trust him in these big moments, but no, look to what happens in game five where they do pass him the ball. He hits this big three to like basically close the game. And then he comes up with a big block on the other end that effectively did close the game. Like they do need him to make an impact. And I think going through, like, I think this series in particular is perfect for the Nuggets developmentally where they are right now. It's going to, you know, the Clippers are one of the best teams in the NBA, have been like that all year, but they lose their focus at times. And so the Nuggets can see that and take advantage of that, and then they can understand the importance of, like, we need to seize the moment every single damn game, which is good. But also, again, like, I don't think Jokic, Murray, MPJ, they just aren't experienced enough yet to be a legit, like, we can win the title this year. But going against this team in particular is going to give them the experience of, okay, this is what it takes to play at a championship level. So now we can go back in the offseason. You know, like, Jamal Murray has not had a great series, which is not a surprise. You're going against Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, Patrick Beverley. We said this going into the series, like, this was not going to be a great Jamal Murray series. And, you know, it's probably a somewhat coming crashing back to earth after, you know, having that amazing duel with Donovan Mitchell in the first round. So, you know, moving forward, you know, we talked about Jamal Murray and that extension, and like, we see these flashes where he lives up to it, and then we see a series like this where it's like, ooh, you're paying Jamal Murray a max deal? Uh-oh. But, you know, moving forward, if Jamal Murray is their third best player and Michael Porter Jr. is their second, I suddenly feel a lot better about the Nuggets' future.
Yeah, I might not feel great about the future financially, but yeah, I understand where you're going with it, because yes, that would definitely take a load off of Murray not having to be reliant on playing such a vital role. Yes, and having someone of the size of Michael Porter to take and make shots is a huge asset. When you are 6'10", 6'11", whatever the hell he is, and can actually dribble the basketball up the court and take and make pull-up threes, that is just an impossible shot to defend, and that is going to basically change entire defenses. I mean, mm-hmm. They have to look at you in a different way. And I agree that Michael Porter Jr. should have that opportunity more so. I just think it's a maturity thing overall.
Yeah.
And because, you know, here's the thing. There's been a lot of attention on him this year, especially in the bubble, because not just for his basketball play. I mean, he did get significantly better, and that's positive, but he also said a bunch of things. Like, everything is just... It's a matter of just knowing when to say things and when to maybe not air out certain things.
Yeah.
And this was just another example of him tripping when you might think, that's just not appropriate timing right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Mike Malone said as much after the game. I think after the game? I don't know, before the game. And he said, during the playoffs, the last thing you want is any kind of distraction. If those frustrations are there for Michael or anybody, it's much better to keep those conversations internal in the locker room and amongst ourselves.
Oh, I didn't see that. That's good.
Yeah, and I assume that that's more what Dame was referring to rather than like, oh, this rookie is like thinking he's, you know, the number one option on his team. Maybe it's some combination of the two. But, you know, again, it's like, for the Nuggets, it's been this juggling act all season, really. I mean, you know, during the regular season, Nuggets fans were very frustrated with Mike Malone for not giving Michael Porter Jr. more minutes and more opportunities, because you see, you know, you take the 3 to 5 year outlook here and you say, you know, for us to hit our ceiling, Michael Porter Jr. has to hit his. So you want to get him those options, but then at the same time, you know, Mike Malone's trying to win games and he's like, Will Barton, Torrey Craig, Gary Harris give us a better chance to win games right now than Michael Porter Jr., who's getting cooked on defense and taking some questionable shots on offense.
Right.
You know, injuries forced his hand in the bubble with Harris and Barton being out. Harris has since returned. Barton's still gone. So it's almost good in a way that, you know, it sucks that Barton's not here because I think he'd make a difference in the series. But, you know, forcing MPJ into these high leverage minutes, I think, will only benefit them in the long run. It's a tough hand for Mike Malone to balance of, you know, we're trying to win games now, but I also understand this kid's importance to our franchise moving forward, and how do you juggle these two?
Right. He knows it too, I should add, because I interviewed CJ McBride, friend of the podcast, for an article on TV2. And one of the questions I asked him was about Jokic and MPJ in terms of their differences. Here's what CJ told me, and here's what he responded. Jokic is a superstar who doesn't want the fame or the buckets. Porter is the superstar sidekick who wants all the fame and buckets. That pretty much sums it up, right?
I mean,
this is where we're at. This is a guy who wants the spotlight. He wants the shot. He wants to be looked at as this type of player, which, in a nutshell, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that whatsoever. It's just more so if you want all the fame and all the highlights and all of that, you got to play a complete game as well. I mean, and you also have to understand you're not going to reach that level if you're calling out your teammates after the game. Mm-hmm. So again, that's why I just keep coming back to the maturity thing. But you know what? Hey, at least good on MPJ for believing in himself, because apparently he doesn't believe in the coronavirus, so he has to believe in something.
Yeah, I'm here for any joke about, like, this is the only shot MPJ wants. Anything along those lines is fantastic. But no, I mean, honestly, like, I would want players to have that mentality. Like, that is, you know, did he handle it perfectly? No. But I would much rather have guys who want the ball in late game situations than guys who shrink away from the moment.
Like, oh, yeah.
This is only a good, again, this whole series is only a fantastic learning experience for the Nuggets. They were playing with house money after they got past the Jazz. Like, this is the best thing for them moving forward. And I just pray to God that they don't rush anything from this, you know, from now on. Like, I don't take after the 2018 Sixers. Like, just keep on keeping on, because you have something special here. And I want to see it reach its, you know, ultimate conclusion. Because I really do think Jokic and PJ Murray could be the top three guys on a championship team.
Yeah, I think, well, I don't know, but I do think it's trending in that direction, yes. I would hope so, at least, because that would make the league more fun.
Yeah. Well, Moritz, let's wrap up on a less fun note.
Yeah.
Daniel House missed Game 3 of the Lakers-Rockets series for quote-unquote personal reasons, which I think a lot of people probably assumed he might have tested positive for COVID. That did not happen, at least that we know of, so that's good. I think between Games 3 and 4, we started hearing some details that the NBA was investigating him for a potential violation of the bubble protocol. And then on Friday night, the league has announced that he has been kicked out of the bubble because he did, in fact, violate the safety protocol. He had an unauthorized guest in his hotel room for multiple hours on Tuesday. There was a lot of controversy about the NBA's handling of this, of keeping him out of games 3 and 4 before the investigation was complete. And then also, you know, going into the details of exactly what he did. So what do you think of the NBA's, how the NBA handled all this?
So I kind of understand if they had some significant evidence initially that proved that, you know, he had unauthorized visit. I have to assume they knew something that we didn't before he missed those games, right?
Right.
I cannot imagine otherwise.
Yeah.
That would just be weird to me. And outside of that, I agree with the NBA's decision, because ultimately that investigation turned into, you know, something solid and something concrete that he had in fact had unauthorized visit, and boom, that's just a no-go. So out on your ass. That's totally fair. What I want to talk about more so than how the NBA responded to this is, you know, this is a sore subject generally, because I think this is this goes back to us being a little bit more political and whatnot. But I have a problem with the way that our NBA community answers to these things. So whenever someone, you know, has sex in the NBA, let's just put it this way, and especially in the bubble, for some reason, it seems that NBA fans are trying to force Taylor Rooks into that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is disgusting behavior. I am extremely upset that this is happening all the time, because what, you know, why? What the hell is that even? It is just a dumbfounding, idiotic thing to do. And I just cannot comprehend why this has happened twice now. Twice has this been brought up in the bubble. It's deplorable. It's dumb. It's every word you can use. And I just don't understand why this keeps happening.
Yeah, the other instance I believe you're referencing was Donovan Mitchell, when he had the, I think it was like an IG live story or Snapchat or something like that. Correct. When it was, yes, like, it just sounded like there was moaning in the background, and, you know, imaginations jumped. To answer your question, I don't know. Like, I, you know, I saw those rumors going around on Twitter, and I was like trying to figure out like who started this, like where did this even come from? Because that, you know, there are like people on Reddit who know things from sources inside the bubble or whatever, like inside the NBA just in general. This did not seem to be one of those cases. It was like literally just some dickhead on Twitter was like started this rumor, and somehow it caught fire. You know, Taylor was tweeting about it and like or making some allusions to it as well, and just kind of being like, y'all are outside of your mind for this. Like, why do you, this is gross. I'm with you. It sucks. And it's like, it's just it's another reminder of what female journalists have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. It's a relic of like the 70s and 80s, when you're like, oh, women can't be in the locker room because they're just gonna have sex with everyone. It's like, no, Taylor's a professional. She'll just do her job and do it really well. Like, I mean, she just left the bubble because her uncle died, so she's, you know, going to be with her family. which is a huge loss for all of us, because she's been asking some of the best questions of anyone in the bubble. Yeah. Like
it's a huge win for her in terms of getting out of the bubble, even though it's under tragic circumstances, though.
Yeah. To not have to deal with this BS speculation, I'm sure would be a relief for her. But yeah, it sucks and it's gross. Like, we should not just jump to those conclusions when Taylor Rooks was not the only woman in the bubble. Like, don't sully her name by just coming up with this out of nowhere.
No, and you know what it is as well? It is so basically, the NBA community has finally, I should add, embraced Doris Burke, which is great because Doris is a treasure. Mm-hmm. And she's by far the best analyst ESPN could ever hope for in terms of basketball, by the way. Now, she's been sort of blue checkmark now, if you catch my drift. Mm-hmm. There's like, oh, Doris is great, beautiful. But why is it that every time a woman tries to break into this business, she has to go through these trials almost of internet trolls every single time? Mm-hmm. That's what I don't get. If a person does a good job, their gender doesn't matter, their sexuality doesn't matter, like anything of those things, like their ethnicity doesn't matter. It's just, we're in 2020. Like, can we move on? Can we have a grown-up conversation about this? It's just idiotic, and I don't understand, and I cannot comprehend why we insist, you know, as a community, of making it so hard for women to break into this business. You know, we had Sarah on this podcast for years. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, and you know this, she's smarter than both of us put together. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
And for some reason, you know, it's again, everyone had to be, this woman has to earn her marks. She has to earn their stripes. F that. It's so dumb. And I just, I wanted to keep this about Daniel House because what he did was completely idiotic. But I really needed to bring this up because it infuriated me.
But I do want to get back to House for a second.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. That was my rant. My apologies. I just had to get it out.
Well, just because I think what you brought up earlier, like, the NBA had to know something that we didn't for this.
Right.
For them to have kept him out of that game, they had to have some pretty clear evidence. And, you know, as it turns out, they did, or else they wouldn't have kicked him out of the bubble.
Right.
And I think we saw this, too, with the bubble protocol in general. You know, when it became clear that the NBA was going to have a bubble in place, there was a lot of, like, instant reaction of, like, okay, cool, but what's the health plan? And then, like, it didn't come out for a while, and there was a lot of, like, oh, well, they don't have a plan at all. Like, this is completely ridiculous. Like, the NBA doesn't have to release all information publicly as it's happening. Like, they're allowed to do things behind the scenes and then just present the finalized plan or the finalized investigation. Right. Like, it would not be fair to Daniel House in this investigation if they're releasing a step-by-step timeline of, oh, okay, well, now we found this, and then now we found this, and now we're going to interview this guy. So clearly the NBA was doing stuff behind the scenes, and, like, there had to be some explanation, public-facing explanation during the investigation, just to say, like, hey, this is why this guy, who is a very important piece to this Rockets team, is being held out. So I think it makes sense that, you know, whoever leaked it to Shams or Woj or whatever did that. But I think the rush to judgment here, where, you know, there were a lot of people who I respect on NBA Twitter that were like, this is total BS. It's like, is it though? Like,
no.
Are we sure that it's BS? Like, can we at least wait for the investigation? I agree. If they, you know, kept him out of those two games and then ultimately realized he didn't do anything wrong, then Rockets fans would have had every reason to complain. But I also don't think the NBA goes to that drastic of a step without having some pretty concrete evidence.
Correct. And that's where I'm at, too, because that would have been irresponsible. And the NBA is a lot of things, but when it comes to these sort of matters, I rarely find them irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. And I saw some critique as well about you know, the statement, like, say he had a guest in his room, and, like, did the NBA need to expose him presumably having sex with this woman? Like, is that gross? And 99 times out of 100, like, if this was just a regular season game and someone got, you know, caught with a girl in his room that shouldn't have been there, no, we don't need to know those details. But when you're paying, you know, the bubble costs the NBA $180 million or something like that, and they've set up this extensive safety protocol just to make sure to maintain the integrity of the bubble, for this dumbass to challenge that for doing whatever he did, he deserves to be put on blast. This is just so egregiously stupid of Daniel House that, yep. I mean, I don't know if there is a clause in his contract for conduct detrimental to the team. Sometimes you can, like, wipe out guarantees in the NFL for something like this. Yep. And I don't think the Rockets would want to do that anyway because he's one of their only affordable players. But, like, they should, like, be able to seek recompense for this, because his loss really, again, I don't think he's the reason they're going to lose this series. But you can't convince me that without Daniel House here, this could have been 2-2 instead of 3-1.
Oh, it could. It absolutely could. Yeah.
So, like, Daniel House is an idiot. It deserves to be put on blast. I know. And apparently he's married. So, like, good. I mean, how stupid can you be? Like, what do you think is going to happen if you get caught? You're going to, of course you're going to get publicly exposed here. And now he has to go home to his very angry wife? Good luck.
Probably ex-wife.
I would assume so. I'm assuming it's trending in that direction, yes.
Yeah. No, it's all fair. And, you know, and I think, you know, for people who are saying, oh, we shouldn't air out his dirty underwear or whatever, yeah, fine. But it was more than that. I don't really care about, you know, the whole cheating aspect, horrible, horrible, horrible. That's not the point. The point is, we are, you know, we are following a league right now that is trying to function within a bubble. It is very, very precise rules that needs to be followed. It is for safety measures.
Yeah.
And that's why I have a problem with what he did.
Yeah.
And just like you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they needed to set a harsh precedent, because if it was just like, oh, yeah, you just have to go through quarantine for 4 days, I'm not saying that would lead to an influx of players doing something similar, especially as we get into these later rounds and you realize, like, oh, crap, missing two games or four games if you're going to make a 10-day quarantine, whatever. Like, that's a big loss. But, you know, there needed to be a harsh punishment. Like, you need to send a strict message saying, if you do this, you're out. No, it's like there is no three strikes policy here. You deliberately... It wasn't like you accidentally crossed the line to get chicken wings like Rashawn Holmes or whatever. It's like you deliberately disobeyed the rules that we set forth here, and you threatened the integrity of this entire thing. Like, God forbid he got COVID and spread it to his team when we haven't had an outbreak in this bubble, which is a minor miracle. Like, God forbid if this idiot is the reason that all fell apart.
I can't wait until he's traded to the Philadelphia 76ers this offseason.
With Russell Westbrook.
No, but you're right. And now the Rockets will have to be without 11.5 points and 6 rebounds a game as well. I mean, that, you know, he's hurting his own team. I would not be surprised whatsoever if his teammates right now are just extremely disappointed in him. And he's going to have to work to get that confidence in himself from them back, you know, that trust level, that he has to work now to get that back, because, or at least I hope so. I really hope that his fellow teammates aren't just, oh, that's okay, it's fine, we'll be back next year. No, I really hope they hold this against him, because what he did was absolutely dangerous.
Yeah. It's just so, like, egregiously stupid. And, I mean, apparently, you know, Shams and Amick reported that there's some suspicion he isn't the only one who's done this kind of thing. And if that's true, right, I hope the NBA catches them, and I hope they get kicked out of the bubble, too.
I agree completely. Like, everyone needs to be caught in this when it comes to these things. It's just, and that's not me trying to be a cop, it's just we need to actually have a safe space.
Yeah, like, we've come this far. I mean, yeah. I get it. You know, it's you've been away for a long time. I can understand that being isolating, and I'm not downplaying any mental health aspect that's going into this thing. But it doesn't seem like that was the case. It just seems like Daniel House is an idiot and deserves all of the bad things that are about to come to him.
Right.
On that uplifting note, Mort, I think that is a good place for us to wrap up. So thank you, as always, for listening in. We will be back, hopefully, in the next few days with the Western Conference Finals preview, but I guess we'll see. It sounds like that won't start until Wednesday, I believe. So we've got a little bit of time. So enjoy the games over the next couple days. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Mort, any movie reviews for us?
A serious review. I've been watching season 2 of The Umbrella Academy, and if you haven't checked out that series at all, just start over, watch both seasons. They're great. Season 2 really took a step up in terms of narrative and execution. It's one of the funnest shows. It's not a comedy, but it's a great show. You really keep yourself entertained by watching it. 10 episodes just go by in a flash. It's great. It's truly great.
Oh, I will have to check that out. I've actually been watching High Fidelity on Hulu, which has since been canceled, and I'm super pissed about it. I know I'm late to the game on it, but it's really good. It's really good.
Yeah. That really sucks with all the streamings, right? Because I fell in love with this series called Sense8 on Netflix.
Yeah.
Really, really good. And then they just canceled it, and they were fortunate enough to actually be able to make a final movie, sort of, say, like, or in 2.5-hour episode to wrap things up. So thankfully it got wrapped up, and there weren't any loose storylines, but I would have loved to see another 3 or 4 seasons of that.
Yeah, it's I guess this is one of the problems with these streaming services, is like you have to be on it. You gotta like go viral right away, basically, to make sure you stay alive. But like, then there are people like me who are 3 years late to everything. You're like, oh no, why'd you cancel this?
Yeah, you're part of the problem. If you had started watching Santa Clarita Diet, for example, it wouldn't have been canceled on a cliffhanger. So thank you, Brian.
I blame the NBA. I only have a few months to binge to binge stuff, and I totally wasted it during the hiatus. So I'm going to need to take advantage whenever the season's over.
Sounds good.
All right. Don't die. Later, man.
Later. Don't die, man.